Welcome to episode 149 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
I'm Gary Ferencik, general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. I am broadcasting today from Mars, Pennsylvania. And to get to Mars, I actually had to drive a little bit past Moon, which is where Pittsburgh International Airport is. And I mention this only because we've got some interesting astronomical events coming up, or celestial events. Later this week is the leap year. And then on April 8th is the total eclipse of the sun. And I just checked the NASA website to see the path of totality. And parts of it strips through a whole, you know, from San Antonio up through Toledo and Cleveland. Lansing is going to be like in the 95% range, and Grand Rapids about 93%. So Chicago, I think you're going to be in the 90% range. And the NASA map's pretty cool to show you how to do, to figure out where you are, where you need to travel if you want to find the closest area of totality. The totality zone at peak is going to last maybe 4 minutes.
So next podcast, you should travel up to the UP and record from Paradise, Michigan.
Or you could go near Ann Arbor and go to hell. I did a triathlon once, and the bike ride went through hell, Michigan.
Yeah.
I had a buddy who lived in Moon Township. Now I know where that comes from. Okay, so on this podcast, we highlight poems, patient-oriented evidence that matters. If you want to get one every day, subscribe to Essential Evidence. You also get a great primary care reference, over 800 chapters, thousands of interactive decision support tools. You can check it out at www.essentialevidenceplus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. You can get CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. For listening, go to IFP.com and click on their online education webpage. This week, we're going to talk about clinical prediction tools for patients using DOACs for atrial fib, cognitively enhanced Tai Chi, is there any other kind, high-dose recombinant flu vaccine in adults 50 to 64, and just watching patients suffer with symptomatic gallstone disease. Kate, kick it off.
Hey, I'm here with an article to talk about assessment of bleeding risk with anticoagulation for atrial fibrillation. Risk scores that you may be familiar with, like the HAS-BLED, were developed and validated when warfarin was predominant. So these researchers set out to develop and validate a new risk score for bleeding risk in patients with AFib who are taking a direct-acting oral anticoagulant, a DOAC. So this risk score was developed in a study with about 5,600 patients who were taking standard dose dabigatran, 150 milligrams twice a day. The primary outcome was major bleeding at 1 year. So this was defined somewhat extravagantly as a two-unit transfusion. One unit is just a minor bleed in their definition. Fatal bleeding, symptomatic bleeding in a critical area or organ, or a 20 gram per liter drop in hemoglobin. Second outcome was life-threatening bleeding at a year, which was defined as, again, bleeding causing death, a four-unit transfusion, or bleeding resulting in a 50 gram drop in hemoglobin, or essentially ICU or surgical intervention. So they developed a prediction model using regression, then they simplified it to a point score, which I'll discuss, and you can see if you happen to encounter our script. They then tweaked the model after applying it to a new cohort from a different study. The C statistic, which old people like Mark call the area under the receiver operating characteristic curve, or OROC, like the OROCs used to keep as a child, as a pet, was 0.71 in the derivation study and 0.72 in the validation study. Pretty good. The final model was then externally validated. This is very important to the nerds out there, in two other cohorts. Then the external validation cohort showed that the DOACs performed better than the HAS-BLED when both scores were applied to the same cohorts. So in this model, this is the important part to the clinically active folks, points are given for age. And this is what age is one of the things that you get the most points for. So your risk of bleeding increases with increasing age. Creatinine clearance, BMI less than 18.5, diabetes, high blood pressure, use of other bleeding-inducing medications like aspirin or NSAIDs, history of liver disease, TIA or stroke, and a history of a previous major bleed. Patients with three or fewer points have about a 0.6 to 1.5% one-year rate of major bleeding, while patients with 10 or more points have a 3.7 to 7.7 rate of major bleeding. So then that risk of major bleeding is can be balanced by the patient's physician and the patient in some shared decision-making against the benefit in terms of stroke reduction, which can be calculated using the CHADS2-VASc scores. And that can be pretty much just sort of calculated out. We used to say that, we recommend anticoagulation when that risk of stroke or high-risk TIA exceeds the baseline risk of major bleeding. So we used to say that in somebody with no previous risk of major bleeding, it was about 2 to 3% in somebody who was starting warfarin. So this gives us just a better sense of what is it like in somebody who's using a DOAC. It's thought to be less, and this sort of confirms that it probably is. So all in all, a new tool in the DOAC era to help us do some shared decision-making with patients about whether it's good for them and what their risks might be. Henry, what do you think?
So first, Kate, this is so dissimilar from the usual kinds of studies that you bring in, although you did bring in sort of the nerdy aspects, and I love you for that. I'm not going to say a lot because I think Mark may have some comments because he's really built an awful lot of his career around clinical prediction models. But I do want to just kind of step back and think about the big picture. Everything that we do to manage our patients involves trade-offs of benefits and harms. And in general, when we mess around with our immune system and with our clotting systems, this is where we tend to have the greatest potential for harm, I think. These are some of the most dangerous things that we do. And so having tools to help to rationally guide and help to balance those kinds of risks, to me, are really critical. So I think it's important that we reflect on how we might counsel a patient then and help to engage in their own decision-making around this. So thank you for doing that.
Gary?
Yeah, when I look at this, and Mark, maybe you can comment on this too, since you've done these clinical prediction rules. First of all, the Hazblood is much easier. This looks like it's a 10 or a 12 item score, which, you know, hopefully will be embedded in the EMRs, et cetera, and just automatically calculated when these types of decisions come up. But when you look at the C statistic, you know, it was maybe 0.05 to 0.1, the difference between the Hazblood as well as the is this actually called the DOAC score?
I guess it's called the DOAC score. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know how important that is, that 0.5 to 1.0 difference between the two scores in terms of bleeding risk. Obviously, it's got some degree of importance. The question is, from a clinical standpoint, are we getting as much bang for our buck with this newer score than the older, more tried and true, and quite frankly, perhaps easier to use Hazblood score?
Yeah, you know, I just was reviewing last night, coincidentally, the new atrial fibrillation guidelines from the American Heart Association and the cardiologists, and it just came out, it's in circulation, and they are pretty skeptical of the previous existing bleeding risk scores and say that in the external validations, when they tested them in new populations, their area under the curve, their C statistic was 0.6 or 0.59 or something like that. So not very good. So it is good to see one that may be a little bit more accurate like this one. There's always, I agree with you, Gary, the information, call it information burden. You know, how much data do you have to gather to use one of these? How much time does it take? And this is a little bit on the, you know, complicated side, but the guideline does continue to recommend the CHADS2-VASc score, and it recommends when you have at least a 2% risk of stroke with atrial fibrillation that you should be on a DOAC. Unless you have some sort of very high bleeding risk, then it kind of becomes a shared decision. So that means a score of 2 or higher on the CHADS2-VASc score. So, you know, I think there's also, you know, obviously just our intuitive sense of a patient's bleeding risk. If we have an 82-year-old who's had significant bleeds in the past, that's very different from a 65-year-old who has hypertension, right? And so I think that's where using these scores, unfortunately, if it's too complicated, it's just not practical to use in practice. So,
One thing that I'll say about this one is all of the items in it. So age is just, that's a very straightforward. You don't have to go through and say, you know, are they 60 to 65? Yes, no. It's just a single click. And all of the items in it are sort of understandable at face value. So you're not digging through the EMR trying to find, you know, some very obscure lab value. It's, you know, do they have diabetes? Yes or no?
Yeah,
unlike some of the others that we use, where it is a little bit more difficult to find the information.
And it's not subjective judgments. You know, some of them, like for DVT, we'll have, is DVT more likely than any other cause, or is something, and that's very subjective. And I've always been a little leery of those. So good stuff. Thanks, Kate. Appreciate it. Gary, you have a quiz for us.
I do indeed. A recent study, I think within the last couple of months, in the New England Journal, investigated the impact of testosterone replacement therapy on the incidence of fractures in middle-aged and older men with diagnosed hypogonadism. After a median follow-up of about 3.2 years, the incidence of clinical fracture was assessed between those who received testosterone, which was transdermal, and those who were given placebo. Based upon the results of this trial, which of the following statements is correct? Number one, testosterone replacement therapy significantly reduced the incidence of fracture compared to placebo. Number two, there was no significant difference in fracture incidence between testosterone and placebo. Three, testosterone treatment was associated with a higher incidence of fractures compared to placebo. And number four, the placebo group had a significantly higher incidence of fractures than the testosterone treatment group.
Okay.
Stay tuned.
All right, Henry, tell us about Tai Chi, cognitively enhanced Tai Chi.
Yeah, so this study asks whether cognitively enhanced Tai Chi versus regular Tai Chi and stretching benefit individuals who have mild cognitive impairment or subjective cognitive impairment. This was published by Lee and colleagues in the Annals of Internal Medicine in November. And this was a single-blinded randomized trial that included just over 300 community-dwelling adults who were at least 65 years of age, who had self-reported memory decline or concern, but scored fairly well on the clinical dementia rating score and did not have existing dementia. And so they were randomized to one of three interventions: standard Tai Chi, cognitively enhanced Tai Chi, or a stretching program. Now, the cognitively enhanced Tai Chi was basically, can you walk and chew gum at the same time? They did Tai Chi, but during Tai Chi, you either had to repeat numbers from the or ignore deliberate miscuing by the instructor. So it was a little bit different and very counter to the very introspective concentration and meditation that goes with traditional Tai Chi. These sessions lasted for an hour twice a week for about 6 months, and it was done by way of Zoom. So think about who these individuals might be. They had it's maybe a little different kind of population than a broader scale. Now, they used the Montreal Cognitive Assessment Scale, or the MoCA, to evaluate changes in cognition over time. And I looked this up last night. The minimum clinically important difference for the MoCA is about 1.5 to 2. So what did they find? Well, at the end of 24 weeks, and it persisted at the 48-week follow-up, those that participated in the cognitively enhanced Tai Chi averaged about 3 points better compared with the traditional Tai Chi, which was about 1.5 point better than the stretching program. So there weren't any major withdrawals in this, and there wasn't really any serious injuries or anything like that. But this was 96% white. Most of them were college educated and had access to Zoom. So does this apply to everybody? Maybe not. And there's a complexity, I think, in delivering this kind of device, so that I don't know that it would be readily available to all of our patients, but it's sort of interesting, nerdy kind of approach.
It is interesting. And, you know, I kind of wonder, I almost wish they had a fourth group that was just the cognitive enhancement, you know, somebody barking questions at you without the Tai Chi. Is it the cognitive enhancement part, or is it the combination? Do you have to be doing Tai Chi too that matter. So, but yeah, that's a pretty big difference, you know, in terms of 2.8 compared to the stretching group. That's a fairly large and you know, significant difference. Kate?
Yeah, I agree. I wonder what the deliberate miscuing by the instructor was, and how that exactly how they were instructed to ignore it, like just to the instructor was saying, "Now put your foot down," and they were supposed to actually keep it up in the air.
Simon says
how that would work. Yeah over Zoom.
The airspeed of a swallow.
It is hard for me to imagine anything more joyless than a Zoom Tai Chi class.
I was thinking the same thing. Oh, shoot me now.
The other arm that I would want to see would be, did you improve even more if you went in person? Because I actually do think that would matter. But in terms of sort of, you know, the ability to generalize this, sure, Zoom could be very effective.
So this brings up to me something I don't know that I've ever actually thought about, which is, are you more cognitively capable of doing maybe moderate to complex learning, if you want to look at it that way, when you're physically active? And I don't know if they had a background, like a background statement leading into this study, but to me, this is a fascinating combination of doing something that's physically challenging while also trying to either learn or pay attention to something you need to pay attention to. And does that enhance, I mean, this particular one, obviously it did enhance the cognitive capacity. Does this translate into language learning and learning, mm-hmm. you know, more complex tasks? You know, could you be running on a treadmill while you're trying to learn Spanish or something like that and actually have an enhanced outcome with regards to that? I think it's a study worth doing, Henry. In your free time, could you maybe think about putting a design together on this?
There you go.
All right, next study. Next study is from the New England Journal, late 2023. Recombinant or standard dose influenza vaccine in adults under 65 years of age. Shao was the first author. And so this was a cluster randomized trial. It was set in the U.S. Kaiser Health System, Kaiser Permanente. And it was not a randomized trial. Oh, no, it was a cluster randomized trial. That's right. They compared a high-dose recombinant vaccine called Flublok with a standard dose inactivated old school kind of influenza vaccine. So during the 2018 to 2020 flu seasons, Kaiser sites were matched by size and they were randomized to either block A, which gave the high dose vaccine an even numbered weeks, or block B that gave it an odd numbered weeks. Ultimately, over 600,000 patients got the high dose recombinant vaccine. About 1 million got the standard dose vaccine. Overall, it was about 44% male, about half were non-white, 74% had gotten flu vaccine the previous year. This was back in the day when people actually believed in vaccines, apparently, you know, before COVID. The primary age group of interest that they really focus on here was 50 to 64 years. So it was a randomized trial, but it was cluster randomized, so they also used something called propensity score matching to adjust for differences between groups. They also used RSV infection, the rate of RSV infection, as a negative control. So you wouldn't expect to see a difference in RSV infections between groups, and they didn't. So that's, you know, lends some credence to the study. The headline in the abstract is that the high-dose recombinant vaccine, the Flublok, was 15% more effective in people 50 to 64. But, you know, let's look at the actual number of cases. The actual number of PCR-confirmed flu cases was 2.0 per thousand in the high dose group and 2.34 per thousand in the usual dose group, about one per 3,000 people. Yeah, I know. Ooh, that's impressive. But they don't present it that way. It's all about how you present the data, right? 15% sounds pretty good. You know, one per 3,000 doesn't sound so great. There was no difference in the actual important outcomes, why we do vaccination, of hospitalization for influenza. I'm sorry you got the flu, but I don't care. I really care about preventing hospitalizations for flu. There was also no difference in hospitalizations for community-acquired pneumonia. The retail price of the Flublok is $90 compared to about $30 for the standard dose vaccine. So there was a very small absolute reduction in the risk of influenza with the high-dose Flublok recombinant vaccine, but no impact on hospitalization or pneumonia. They do say that in theory, these recombinant vaccines may be less likely to have a mismatch, maybe more likely to have a good match due to antigenic drift from year to year. But that really was, you know, is theoretical. That wasn't in this, the years of the study, the vaccines were relatively poor match for both of the vaccines. So anyway, super impressive, huh, Gary?
Yeah, two things. When you start teaching statistics again, you got to pull this out in terms of how statistics can be misleading depending on which metric you use. A quick question. Actually, I got the high dose flu vaccine this year. I didn't know about the study. I might have chosen differently. I didn't see in this, and I didn't dig deeply, but when you look at the adverse effect rate, were they roughly the same between the two groups as far as you remember?
Yeah, they were roughly similar. Yep.
All right. Yeah. I mean, you're looking at here a point.
Often, it's a good point because often the high dose vaccines, so for example, with the multivalent HPV vaccines tend to have more local inflammation, pain, that local reaction than the less valent, the ones that have fewer antigens. So yeah, it's certainly possible.
Yeah.
So I wonder, you know, it's a recommendation from the ACIP that that older adults get the high dose flu vaccine. So I wonder what data they were looking at or what their outcomes were. Was it just a lower incidence of, you know, sort of all flu cases, or was it, you know, sort of these more hospitalizations, deaths? So what was it that drove that recommendation in the first place? Or was it just older data, different, you know, set of flu vaccines, better match, that got us that recommendation in the first place?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the ACIP traditionally has been more of an expert-based panel that didn't have quite the rigorous approach that the USPSTF, for example, has. They have really improved their methods considerably over the last 5 years or so and are, in theory, looking more closely at evidence. But often they might be looking at antibody levels and things like that rather than actual clinical outcomes. As far as I know, this is the first big study to address that. Henry?
Yeah, so remember, the recommendation for the high dose is for 65 and older for the most part. This study was the 50 to 64-year-old age group, which probably put some little dampening effect on recommendations for, you know, older adults in that 50 to 64 group.
Yeah, a 15% reduction might be a little more clinically significant in an older population. That's true.
Good well, point. And I think a 15% reduction, when you're looking at millions and millions of people, is a big number.
Yeah, you know, then we have to decide, is an extra $60 times 3,000 worth preventing one case of the flu? You know, sorry, flu's no fun, but it's not, you know, if you're not changing hospitalizations, that's what we care about, right?
Right.
And severe cases.
Yeah. Now, if it's my case of the flu, then it's worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, of course, obviously. Prevent that.
Mark, you're priceless.
Thank you.
Literally priceless.
Yeah. Kostenlos. Okay, Gary.
All right. So is it safe to watch patients with symptomatic, when underlined, symptomatic gallstone disease who present without complications? Now, paradigm is that there are many, many of us walking around who've got asymptomatic gallstones that, and Mark raises his hand, that will in all likelihood not cause us problems in our lifetime. And therefore, preemptively taking the gallbladder out in somebody who feels fine doesn't likely produce symptoms, but when you produce improvement. But when you have a patient who's symptomatic, you know, which I had never thought about this. I just thought, you have symptoms, get your gallbladder out, period. So this was called the CGALL, C-G-A-L-L trial. It's a pragmatic, multi-centered, randomized superiority trial. Compared conservative management, pain management, with laparoscopic cholecystectomy among about 434 adults who had uncomplicated, kind of an important concept, uncomplicated gallstone disease. There was a whole list of exclusion criteria. Obviously, if the stone was in the common bile duct, if they had evidence of previous cholecystectomy, lithiasis, pancreatitis, obstructive jaundice, et cetera, et cetera. So there's probably seven or eight of the exclusion criteria here. So these were simple pain, thought due to gallstone disease, randomized to either conservative versus laparoscopic surgery. Their primary outcome was a quality of life measure after 18 months. They measured this specifically in the SF36 body pain domain, the short form health survey, which uses a score between 0 and 100, whereas a higher score is a higher quality of life or a better quality of life. Now, so when they looked at that as their primary outcome, that is the scores between the two groups in the SF-36 short form survey, no significant differences. Indeed, the p-value was 1.0. I don't think I've ever seen a between group difference in which the p-value was 1.0. Now, so there was no difference in how they reported, you know, basically mostly body pain after about 18 months. However, at 18 months, about 1 in 4 who were initially randomized to conservative therapy ultimately had their gallbladder out. And just 3 or 4 months later, went up to 29% by 24 months, by 18 months to 24 months, or 6 months later. And so there was a high percentage of the minority of patients, I should say, but a pretty high percentage who ultimately went on to have a cholecystectomy within 2 years. So depending on the circumstances, everything in medicine depends on circumstances, conservative management for uncomplicated but symptomatic gallstone or gallbladder disease may be a viable alternative to surgery in the short-term management of these patients. And so long story short here, this was a study that I thought was important because I don't think I've ever seen a study in which symptomatic disease for gallbladder disease, particularly gallstone disease, was never wasn't operated on. So this is kind of a new paradigm for me. I'm not quite ready to jump onto the bus right now, but it'd be interesting in your thoughts on this.
This is another one where, you know, increasingly we're finding that surgery just, it isn't as good as we thought it was for so many conditions. And we'll just add this one to the list. I did just read a study that said that septoplasty for people with severe sinus symptoms seems to work better than medical management. We can add that one to the positive list. But, you know, you said that the over 2 years, almost 30% of people wound up having their gallbladder out. But 70% of people 2 years later still had not had surgery. And so I think, you know, even if it's a little bit like all the appendicitis articles that have come out that, you know, said, so there's a substantial proportion of people who, you know, who are initially treated with antibiotics for appendicitis who do wind up having, you know, a surgical intervention. But in terms of it being an option or shared decision making, I think this may, you know, again, if a few other studies sort of confirm it, this may, like you said, turn out to be a little bit of a paradigm shift.
You know, that's a good point, Kate. I'd forgotten about those appendicitis studies in which watchful waiting for uncomplicated appendicitis had almost the exact same type of a paradigm. Most people did well, but a substantial minority ended up needing surgery within a period of time.
So this study took place in the United Kingdom. And so my question is, here in the United States, will this play in Poughkeepsie? Right? Will Americans be willing to undergo the monitoring and whatnot? I agree that this is an opportunity for shared decision making. One of my questions, though, is what was it for those that got the surgery? What tipped them over? Okay, was it that they just got fed up, that they were just worried, or were they having repeated episodes? And I asked this in part because I had my gallbladder out shortly after I retired, and it was largely because of multiple episodes chills and sweats that accompanied the usual kind of symptoms, and I just basically just got tired of that. And so the question really is to whom, you know, who did the ended up with the surgery? Were they those that had more other kind of symptoms, or did they just have traditional right upper quadrant pain triggered by fatty meals? And then my last question about this is that the savings that they talk about, to whom did the savings accrue? Did the patients actually save anything, or was it to the healthcare system? In which case, in the United States, there we're probably talking about tens of thousands of dollars, not just the thousand or so that occurred in the UK.
So, Henry, if I understood your comment correctly, you got tired of having recurring sepsis?
Yeah.
You're weak, man. You know, here's the issue. If I was to give you an option, hey, Henry, we're going to give you $1,000 if you don't give your gallbladder out that you're symptomatic right now. Is that going to incentivize you? Are you going to say, okay, I'll spend my grand?
You know, it does remind me when I was a medical student reading Cope's early diagnosis of the acute abdomen, which I don't know if anybody reads anymore. It was this classic text written 100 years ago by some surgeon named Cope, and he himself had gallstones, and he described in exquisite detail the symptoms, what could provoke them, how it was positional. And I just remember loving that book, and you know, just really, it really turned me on to diagnosis as something that's my favorite thing in medicine. So Cope's diagnosis of the early abdomen or early diagnosis of the acute abdomen, something like that.
I still think that's a classic text.
Yeah, I think everybody should read it. But
yeah, it's kind of like Grey's Anatomy. I mean, everybody knows it.
I've seen that show too. All right. Oh, that's different. Okay, Gary, you got the quiz answer for us.
I do indeed. So remember, the basic question was essentially, in middle-aged, average age 64 men, does testosterone replacement therapy in men who are documented to be hypogonad decrease fracture risk? And it makes a certain amount of sense that it might. So this was a trial, it was a sub-trial of a larger trial called the TRAVERSE trial, whose primary aim was to assess the cardiovascular risk of testosterone transdermal therapy versus placebo among about 5,000 men, average age 64 with hypogonadism. The cardiovascular trial, Mark, it'd be interesting to get your comment on this, was non-inferior to placebo. I always thought non-inferior, it just seems like an awkward way of saying things. But anyways, the cardiovascular trial suggested there was no cardiovascular difference in between men on testosterone versus placebo. This was a sub-trial. They looked at fracture risk. They followed them through for about 3.2 years, and fracture had occurred in 3.5% of the testosterone group versus basically 2.5% in the placebo group, suggesting a numbers needed to harm of 1 in 100. So every 100 men on testosterone, you had one extra fracture. So there was no, interesting, there was no substantial difference in the incidence of typical osteoporotic fractures at the spine, hip, humerus, and wrist. They were mostly seen in the ribs as well as the ankles, suggesting that perhaps men were more active. Men went out and put themselves in harm's way and then developed the types of fractures that might occur when you're overly active. However, long story short, no substantial between-group differences in the incidence of the osteoporotic fractures, the perhaps more traumatic fractures. There seemed to be a higher incidence of overall NNH was about 100, where testosterone was actually worse when it looked at this idea of fracture risk.
Yeah, and it's interesting. And I think you're right. That was the first thing I thought of too, was maybe they're just feeling better and getting out more and being more active, and that has its own benefits. So yeah, you incur a little fracture risk, but maybe.
No, this is just basically for stupidity caused by steroids.
Okay.
And then there's don't exercise. The take home message. Don't be active.
And I conclude it's an obviously harmful medication with no clear benefits, and we shouldn't be prescribing it. Increases fracture risk, just no use for it.
And certainly no cardiovascular benefit.
Right. That's what we would conclude if it was being prescribed to women.
Fair. Totally fair. Okay. Well, thanks everybody for listening, and thanks you guys for participating. You can get CME credit from the IFP.com, and it's a half a credit for just listening and answering a few questions. And we hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Tell your friends about our podcast. We'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.